But tonight it is my great privilege to... tell me how to pronounce your last name. I was going to ask you before, but I forgot.
Danisso.
So, Sharon Danisso, she is... she has a master's in women's spirituality and is the founder and director of the nonprofit Women's School of Healing, Arts, and Sciences. And tonight she will be speaking about love, self-love, and the body from the perspective of women's spirituality. Thank you very much for coming to Mary River.
Well, I hope I can do all that, actually. Well, hello, and I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad you're here, so thank you for coming. And I am going to get to the women's spirituality part of this, but there's really so much to say about love that there's much more than I can just cover. You know, I feel like if we make a little teeny inroad in this, it will be something valuable and useful. I'm a person that has been on a spiritual path for a long time. In my own journey, my own healing journey and my spiritual studies, I found that very little was said about love, but that's where things led me. And so spirituality seemed much more pure. It's actually been the psychologist that I've ended up turning to a lot, who really look at feelings and deal with those things. So when I came here, I had read some books and had a lot of thoughts and had my own experience, and I knew what I was going to say, and since then I've read about 5 or 6 more books. So my brain is kind of overloaded, you know, with information. And normally I'm pretty extemporaneous, but I wrote myself notes because I really want to impart some of what I've learned. It's been so important to me. It's just been like a revolution in my brain, and it's brought everything into focus and made it very clear. And so I want to share. And also, we're going to have questions. I'm only going to speak for, I don't know, you know, like half the time or whatever, until I say what I say, but I'll try and keep that short, because I think that what you know is also very relevant, that we learn from each other. It's, you know, I'm not an authority on love really any more than anybody else is here. So we will have lots of time for sharing and questions of each other as well as of myself. And I will try to the best of my ability to share what I've learned. So, and we're being recorded, so you're going to be on the website. So if you have a question, just step right up when it's time. But before we get to questions, I'm going to speak a little bit. And I really, it's because I care, which I think many of you do too, or you wouldn't be here probably, about what's happening in the world, about what's happening to people I know, about what's happened to myself. It's all very interrelated. It's not me without the world, and it's certainly not the world without me. So, you know, I care, and my interests have brought me here. My interests, my personal interests, my education, my experience in life, the cards I've had to deal with, in order to get, I don't even know what to say, but when I was in my 50s, I noticed that everything fell apart. And I wasn't an alcoholic, I wasn't in debt, I didn't, you know, nonetheless, everything fell apart. So I had to really come to terms with things, and I had to start looking for different ways of handling things. And that's what led me here. My natural interests and inclinations and the experience of life that I had to deal with. And I think you'll find some similar things. You may learn... Well, I will. Okay. So firstly in all this, I came to see that love is really was the answer to my problems. Learning to love myself, learning to love other people, it was just like a blinking light. It couldn't be clearer. That was the only piece of information that I was missing that I needed. And I think that that's the piece of information that the world needs. And what love looks like takes different forms, but you know it, you know. So, and the second thing that I learned, which really surprised me, was that love has to be expressed physically. Love is of the body. Love is of the body. It's a body experience. It's a feeling experience, which is a body experience. It has to be expressed through an action, which is of the body. The idea of love does not transmit love. The smile transmits love. The act of kindness, the hug, the touch, the embrace, the silent sit by me, and we'll sit through this in silence and just be together. That is where love is communicated, through touch. And I think that was partly shocking because in what my culture, our culture, has raised, the tradition is that the body is less important and less valuable than the mind. So I'm going to read you a couple things. This is actually about the Buddha. This is called Lust for Enlightenment, Buddhism and Sex. It's by a man, John Stevens. I know very little about him except he's a Zen scholar, and he spoke here, and he's spoken highly of. But in Western tradition, we can go back to the Greeks, and we can read Plato, and Plato made it very clear that the rational mind, the logical mind, was superior to the emotional body being, and that pure mind and pure ideas were superior to anything that could live or exist. So a pure table is much better than a table, than any table, which I don't, that never quite made sense to me, but you know, that is our tradition, that mind is superior to matter, spirit is superior to matter, the body is less. Well, it turns out that it's not only Greeks and Christianity and our secular thing, because here's what the Buddha said, much to my shock. I was shocked. I learned a lot of things when I started reading, and I was shocked. So, here's something that he says about sex. Like a moth consumed by flame, those set ablaze with passion have no refuge. Then here's something he says about women. The one thing that enslaves a man above all else is a woman. Her form, her voice, her scent, her attractiveness, and her touch all beguile a man's heart. Stay away from them at all costs. Funny, but it's us, you know. It's us, and it's how we were looked at. So how does anything we have to offer have any value? How can we even love ourselves? Okay, there's a couple more here. If that wasn't enough. To cure such addictions to the pleasures of the flesh, Buddhist texts prescribe a number of remedies, the most effective being meditation on the loathsomeness of the body, a device Gotama used to good effect when he himself was enticed by Mara's daughters. So Buddha was tempted by a number of things, and one of them were these very attractive women. And what he said to them was, "Beautiful you may seem, but from the crown of your heads to the soles of your feet, you are nothing more than bags of skin filled with blood, pus, and filth." So, and the Buddha resisted his mother welcoming his mother as a nun. She wanted to be a nun, and he did not want that to happen. It was quite a long journey before that can happen. So, in our world, many things I love about Buddhism, as I do about all religions and spiritual pathways, this is a really horrifying thing to have happened. And we're living with the effects of that. So I found myself in women's spirituality symbolism, because I felt most comfortable with the people and the thinking in that. Women's spirituality is not paganism, but it's got some things in common with it. It's a feminist spirituality. It seeks to empower women for who they are, but it's also there's some tenets like direct relationship to the divine. Like, everybody is their own authority in women's spirituality. There's no hierarchy, there's no head woman, there's no line, there's no book that's the book. There's just a conversation that goes on among women who are interested. And the things that they value are things that I value. For instance, the life cycle, the yearly cycle and the life cycle as a model for living, that's another thing. You know, like a tree, it's a seed, it's a plant, it has fruit, it drops its fruit, its leaves fall off, the tree kind of goes dormant, and then it comes back to life again. It's a different model than we're here and we want to get to heaven. That's a linear model of thinking rather than a circular model of thinking. So on the linear model, you try and be good, and when you fall off the path, you get back on. You have guilt, you feel bad, you are atone, you get on the track, and you're going to get someplace, but that place isn't even in this life. And who knows if it's really true? That's all a belief system. So women's spirituality is like, what's here and now? Life is here and now. The life that we see around us. The body is important, not just my body, but your body, the body of plants, of animals, the earth, the body of the earth, Gaia. And so, in contrast to that, here's something, again, from what Buddhist is. And Gautama replied, "Even if I became ruler of the world and were able to provide my subjects with every physical need, they would still suffer from sickness, old age, and death. If I attain enlightenment, I can cure the spiritual anguish of all beings." Well, in many cultures, in tribal cultures, old age is not a bad thing. Like, elders are revered. They're the teachers. They taught us how to live and survive in the world, and they taught us love. They were loving to us. It's not a bad thing to grow old, and death is not looked at as a bad thing. And people who've had near-death experiences will say it's very peaceful and it's very beautiful. So in women's spirituality, these things are honored, as opposed to looking at them with fear or with something abhorrent, something not that's not good not to have. So, joyful people out there. So the idea, so coming from a woman's spirituality, that's why I even have this topic, that love, self-love, and the body are related, and they are intimately related. And probably I won't have much time to talk about self-love, but that is the door. Meditation is the door to the inside, sitting in silence. And if we were tribal, we would be spending a lot of time in silence under a tree and looking at a sunset and by a river. And that's when we connect with ourselves. So that's like a very important contribution of Buddhism, in my opinion, to this culture, because it teaches us a way to be with ourselves. And that's the beginning of self-love. If you can't even contact yourself, how can you love yourself? So it's very important to take time out and to learn to do the things. And maybe I'll come back to that a little bit, because it is important. But anyway, so these are books that I've had that I've read, and you're welcome to look at them afterwards. These are the authors that have nourished me and sustained me and taught me along the path. Byron Katie, Leslie Temple Thurston, Thich Nhat Hanh, John Wellwood, Wayne Mueller, that's supposed to be M-U-L-L-E-R, that's here. How then shall we live? A beautiful, beautiful, very, just the title is loving. Being, belonging, and doing. You know, I had to search sideways to get the frontal view. It kind of came together at the end. Carol Crist is the theologist of women's spirituality who talks about empathy, talks about the body, of the women's spirituality authors, and Starhawk talks about it too, a lot about it too. And Starhawk considers herself of the goddess religion as well as paganism, so she's kind of got her feet in both camps. Those are not the same thing. Those are not the same religion. Janov, I'm going to talk about a lot tonight. Louise Hay, Eric Frome, Marianne Williamson, many, many people. So this is a spiritual bookstore. You may find these here. Support your local bookstore and order books and do all that. Okay, so Carol Crist in Rebirth of the Goddess talks about the body being important. She talks about empathy. Empathy and feelings are of the body. Louise Hay says a feeling is a thought running through the body. Mm-hmm. And Janov says emotion is energy that makes you move. It's an energy experience in your body that makes you want to do something, move. It makes the body move, wants to make the body move. Energy in motion, feelings are of the body, and they are how we know we're real. It is our experiences, our physical contact, and our emotional experiences that let us know that we're here. So it's very important for us to learn to connect with love and to learn how to bring it more and more into our life. Okay. So, when I'm in my mind, I'm not totally here. And I've been in my mind and out of my body for about 66 years. So I have a lot of experience. You may have that too. You may have some of the experiences that I'm talking about. I wouldn't be surprised because our culture is very not only anti-woman, it's anti-emotion and it's anti-relationship. And how do you raise healthy children when you're anti all those things? So, Marianne Williamson says, without love, when you're not loved, you become neurotic. So not enough to push you into the psychosis, you know, category. But, hey, we're pretty much all neurotic. You know, we've got ACDC, AFG diseases, or we're addicted to something, or we're terrified of things. She talks about free-floating anxiety. We're anxious. Those things come from poor loving experiences as children and infants. I'm going to talk more about that. And Elizabeth Browning, I love this quote, says, love may not be what makes the world go around, but it is what makes it worth the ride. So, mostly I came to know through my own experience, and then I turned to reading to find out what is going on here. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about my story. That was a big debate. Do I tell people about my story? But I just want to, you know, this I did for myself, and it was just my way of integrating. It's like, I am a person who's interested in spirituality. And these are some of my, you know, I studied many pathways, Native American. You know, I've looked at everything that comes along, Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, tribal, African, all of it. That's been an interest of mine since 1970. And before that, I was in the Peace Corps, so that's kind of actually a spiritual path in a way to me, too. So I don't know when my spiritual path started, and I didn't know what to call it until maybe 10 years ago. So, and myself in the world, I'm a teacher, and I've become a spiritual teacher, and I do healing work with people because of my interests. But really, a lot of what fuels it and gave it impetus and drive was my own healing experience. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about this, because they all gathered here. This is the end of the story. And all I can do now is do more. Be more loving and bring love. Share love more. Help other people find love more. Love more. It's all about love. That's it. And enjoying love. Simple. So I'm going to just say that...
So the Beatles were right?
Yes. And the 60s, the love ends of the 60s were right. Love. They were right. They had a glimmer. It's amazing that it happened. It's like a candle in the dark, those times, and what they did. So, okay, we'll come back to more comments about that. Can name a song. So, my own experience was one of neglect. I'm going to give you some background, but I'm going to be brief. I hope to be brief, but because it gives meaning and context, and you may be able to relate to it, or someone you know may be related to it. But I've heard people talk a lot about abuse. I was probably emotionally abused, but I was not physically abused or sexually abused. But I was neglected, because my mother was in love with a man that she married at 20. And when she was 3 months pregnant with me, he fell off a two-story roof and became a paraplegic. So it turned out that he was an epileptic, and my mother didn't tell that to her mother until the night before she got married. And knowing that, for some reason, my mother's father gave him a job on a roof, one of his businesses, a second-story roof. Now, that's not a really smart thing to do for an epileptic, and he fell off. And, of course, his mother, who loved him, I think he was a pretty cool guy, was furious at my mother and her family for doing that. And he didn't die. They took him back. His mother took him back and took care of him till I was in my 30s, when somebody gave me an obituary. My stepfather gave me an obituary. I didn't even know that he was alive, because the trauma that my mother experienced from that and from previous things in her life. My grandmother was an immigrant. They were lots of traumas, I think, in the whole moving to America thing and everything, learning to fit in. And I forget where I was.
My stepfather gave the obituary.
Oh, right. So in my late 30s, I found out that my father had died, and I discovered that he'd been alive. And I don't know that he was very far from where I lived in Los Angeles. But I don't, because that's where the obituary was published in the LA Times. So I was afraid to ask my mother, because my mother had become depressed and suicidal. And when I asked her things, I once sent her to a movie, in a Bergman movie. It's kind of a downer movie, I have to admit. But she had to be carried out of the film thing, you know, the movie theater. And she would go into mental institutions. When I was 13, she started going into mental institutions. Well, I really didn't want to stir the pot too much, you know. So I was very compassionate for her. I was very sad for her. So I wasn't pushing to find out things that would have been beneficial for me. I kind of erased myself. That's my personality. And in favor of kind of trying to support her and helping her. And but I didn't know any of this, because who remembers what happens as an infant? You don't remember that. It wasn't the first clue I got was in my late 40s, shortly before my mother died, and she said my grandmother wanted her to have an abortion. Well, I had never heard that before. I always thought I was the love child of this special relationship. My mother remarried and had two more children. That man was very kind to me, and he adopted me, he fed me, he clothed me, but I didn't have a relationship, any intimate relationship with him. He never took me for ice cream. My mother didn't take me for ice cream either. Nobody took me shopping. I was just there. So I was like there with nobody talked to me really, and we lived in a suburb. It was brand new. Nobody knew anybody. All the women in the 50s were in their houses with their refrigerators depressed, taking Thorazine, you know. So there was no network in my community. We lived far away from half mile down a big hill to the closest store. You know, it was just a freak of isolation. And no one to turn to, and no one to really mirror me or give me any feedback. So I had very little identity. Very little identity. And I think of myself as a snail without a shell, you know, or a clam. I really didn't learn how to be a person in the world, but I was a kind person and my karma was good, you know, and I think I was very protected, maybe so that I could do this, what I'm doing now. I don't know, but I had very little defensive and very little ways of knowing how to be in the world and no skills at how to be in the world. So maybe that's why spirituality became my path, because there's great solace in spirituality, and that's probably what I needed, seeing as I didn't have a mother. And eventually there's a book called In Her Image by Kathy Carlson, a psychologist, who writes about how for many women the goddess does become the mother that they never had. So I'm not alone in that. So anyway, you know, I was kind of shy and I faded away but anyway, I didn't know anything about that until I was, so in my 40s I learned that my grandmother, who was my caretaker for the first 4 years when my mother went back to work and back to school, who swept me, as they say, from card game to card game with her girlfriends, put me in a basket, but she really didn't want to take care of me. She didn't really want to have anything to do with me. She really resented it. And she is the one that pushed my mother to marry again. My mother married a man she wasn't compatible with. But he was kind and he was good, you know, and I appreciate about that. But she continued to be depressed because she had a college education. He had an eighth grade education. She wanted to go to the plays and concerts, and he wanted to go to the baseball game and play poker, and he would fall asleep at the opera, you know. So anyway, so then when I was in my 50s, everything fell apart, and then when I was in my 60s, I ran into Byron Katie work. And I just knew that that was the work for me, and I did that every day for a year. I lived in a little apartment in Santa Rosa by Spring Lake and took walks, and every morning I did this inquiry work. And after a year, I said, oh, I'm not depressed anymore. It wasn't my intention to get depressed, but it happened just through the process of this work. And that was great, but then I came out in the world, so that was dealing with the depression and healing from that with Katie Wirth. Then I went back, came out of that, and I went to school, and I got my master's, and that was good. I found camaraderie and like-mind and intellectual stimulation and a place in the world, you know, a location where there's two master programs in women's spirituality in the whole world. They're both in the Bay Area. And that's the only place I found my people that I related to and could talk to. And I love them. They're fabulous women, and you would like them too. So that was, then I went to the world, and then I decided to try having a relationship. And that was, that was a major downgrade. That really took me back to my infancy, because even though I got out of depression, I haven't learned anything new about how to relate to people. I just got undepressed. So that was the next year and a half or 2 years. That took me back to my most darkest black moments that I can only assume were my infant experience or my fetal experience of being alone without anybody. Just pre-verbal, it's just blackness. And that was very hard for me to come out of, but I had this tool, Katie, and now I had another tool from Leslie Temple Thurston called the Square and Polarities. And over time, and time does things too, I use these tools to get out of that, and not just to get out of it, but to help me learn how to relate in a positive way. And nonviolent communication taught me some things. You know, it taught me how to communicate some things. Everything I learned taught me something, as I'm sure you have tried many things, and they all add up to something. So ultimately what I came to was loving myself. I had to love myself, and sometimes that meant actually hugging myself. And actually, I made a tape once to myself to welcome myself as a baby, and I listened to that tape. I had to hear it. It's physical. I had to hear it. I had to sense it. I had to imagine myself, you know, being kissed all over my face like a baby would. I mean, it's sort of embarrassing to be 67 and having to treat yourself as a baby, but that's what Janov says, actually. You have to go back. To heal, you have to reconnect with those original experiences and heal them. And I did that. Louise Hay was helpful, you know, everywhere. I go everywhere. Mm-hmm. So you have to be in the body. You have to experience, love is experienced through the body only. It does not felt as an idea. The idea of love will never make you feel one iota better. It has to be somebody giving you a hug, smiling at you, touching you, giving you time, giving you attention, taking you out for tea, giving you a little present. Doing, it has to be an action. And Thich Nhat Hanh said that. He said, he says, love is an action. He took the Buddhist nuns and placed them side by side, the monks, instead of walking behind them at the end in a line behind, he put them next to them. It was an action. And Marianne Williams will talk about it being feelings or energy, but it's also action. Love is communicated through action. It is experienced in the body from actions that happen to us. So we need to know that, because we need to amplify our ability to love to ourselves and to other people, or we're just, you know, the planet's going to just decompose. So the last thing I want to say, I'm going to pass this around. The last book that I've read is this book by the Primal Scream Man. Maybe you remember John and Yono doing Primal Scream, Primal Therapy. Arthur Janov is his name, and I don't remember his training. Here's a picture of him, though. Looks like a hippie. And this book is called The Biology of Love. And I read this, and it just, like, really shocked me. And I learned, and you may learn about yourself, that you have brain damage, as I have. And so I'll pass this around so you can look at it. But these over here on this side are normal brain cells on the dark side. And I guess I could come closer, but I will pass it around just so, you know, just give you a skim now. Normal brain cells over here, lots of them, okay? A lot of interactive things going places, dendrites, axons. And this is the brain when the infant, fetal, and up to 18 months does not get love. This is what happens to the brain cells. There aren't very many. So there are not very many chemicals. There are not very many receptors for chemicals. I'll just pass that if you want to look at it. You can. So what I learned from Janov is, and after I tell you this, I'm going to stop and, you know, I'd like to hear your responses and, you know, comments. Okay, parental love in the early stages affects us and directly relates it to the body. He shows how love affects our brain, the body, and why we can't love, don't sleep, have nightmares, are driven, can't do relationships, are addicted. Mother's love translates to biochemistry of her child, and that sculpts the brain. The loved brain is different than the unloved brain. Loving mothers pass on more oxytocin, vasopressin, and serotonin, causing a different brain and a different person. Those chemicals are calming. They give you the confidence to overcome stress, anxiety, challenges. Without them, you tend to be anxious and hyperactive, neurotic. I'll go back to reading. He calls this imprinted pain from these early times. And imprinted pain is from pre-birth and birth. It's non-conscious. Before and after birth, the brain develops really rapidly. But the lack of stimulation or emotional interaction between parent and child, and we remember my generation, we were still raised, I think I passed it on a schedule. You don't pick the baby up when it cries. It's just going to cave into its desires, and it has to, these are the hours, and this is how much it gets to eat, and that's it. It's like, that is horrendous to a baby. That's just like so traumatic. So all people my age practically are all demented. Anyway, there's not enough interaction, there's not enough synapses, the connections between them, there's just not enough. So there's less dendrites, there's less free-floating hormones, there's more free-floating hormones, there's less receptors, there's a certain kind of toxicity in the brain because these things aren't being removed, and this may explain some of the reasons why we don't have sympathy and can't be calm with ourselves and with other people. Little love by caregivers, male and female, changes the thinking cortex and the feeling limbic system. So the cortex is the thinking brain, the limbic is the feeling brain, and the brain stem down here is the intuitive brain. Nerve cells and certain brain cells do not develop properly. Prefrontal cortex will not function to full capacity later in life. This change that happens cannot, if it happens in the infancy, does not get better when you're 3 years old or 4 years old or 6 years old or 10 or 20 or 60. Those brain cells, they stay that way through life. Unless you do one thing, which is the healing thing, going back to the original incident. And then your cells will start to grow. If you don't go back, your cells stay stunted. When they are stunted, these are things that happen. You have less self-control. That means you can't say no to things. You trust yourself in social situations because you don't know how you're going to react. You might be impulsive. You might go buy a car when you don't have the money, or you might find that in yourself that there's some way that you are impulsive. You don't have the ability to plan ahead as well. You have impaired ability to plan ahead. That is a real loss in terms of human functioning. I experienced that. It's kept me from doing career things. It's kept me from all kinds of things, financial planning, lots of things that I might have done differently if I'd had more brain cells. It limits your ability to think abstractly, and it impairs your motor coordination. Now, for me, I experienced that in not awkwardness and not clumsiness, but I'm really slow. I do everything really slow, which is nice. It's calm. People like it. But, sometimes I might want to have a little pizzazz, or I might want to go dancing, but I'm so habituated to this slowness. It was a part of neglect. It was part of numbness. It was a part of disappearing. It was a part of not wanting to be here or being small. It's not to my advantage to be that way. Some of the other things that can result are due to malfunction of this, due to lack of love, are hyperactivity, all the compulsive things, ADHD, restlessness, lack of inhibition, just being distracted, not being able to focus. I have that. Inability to think logically or linearly. So what's love got to do with it? It's got a lot to do with it. Love children are smarter, healthier, more capable children and become more self-sufficient adults and can deal with authorities and domineering cultures and you know, being diminished by and being having to face challenges to overcome a culture that makes it hard, that a culture that denies feeling, for instance, that denies relationship, you know, but you're more resilient at least if you have, if you've been loved. So nothing in adult life can radically alter what happened to us as infants even before birth. That's a quote. A happy, well-nursed pregnant woman equips her fetus and baby with anti-anxiety and anti-pain chemicals so as to surmount obstacles and adversity. So basically, if we hug and kiss and adore your child, if you hug, kiss, and adore her or child, she will get the message and her life will be utterly different. If we don't, words do not help. There's nothing you can say to a person who is unloved that's going to make them feel any better. And they may not let you love them because they're so, have formed the defenses, not being able to receive. How much of us cannot receive even a compliment without saying, oh, it's nothing, or really. So, in closing, I'll just say love is concrete. Love is our natural state. Babies come in loving. Plants, animals are loving. They're all loving. We have to unlearn being unloving, really. We need to go back to who we are as children, who we are, our natural state. And that's what a lot of us are doing with our own healing processes. So, and also, love is the center, is the core of the divine, it's the essence. And in my mind, I think of love as the feminine feeling aspect, the being aspect of the divine, and the masculine aspect, and you don't have to buy this or anything, is the active, with the doing aspect, which I call the creative, when you take an action. And they need to work together or nothing happens. But the feminine is really primal. The feminine is the possibility. The feminine is the potential. The feminine is beingness from which all the other action takes. And our feelings, we're taught, come out of our thoughts. So that's why we change our thinking. We want to change our thinking so we can feel better, so we can have a better life. So what we want to be is, we want to be loving all the time. Just like we learn to meditate, then we take meditation into full time. I can meditate, I can be present all the time, unless I'm going fast, and then I'm not present to hardly anything. So I have to slow down. But being present in itself is, like, the purpose, I think, of being present is that you see the beauty of things, and you learn to love things, and, you know, you're present to a leaf, or a color, or a sensation. It, ultimately, it's love is where we want to get, because love is what makes us feel good, and love is what makes the ride worth taking. So we really need to learn to be in love all the time. And that's a discipline, and it's a practice. That's spiritual practice. That is my spiritual practice right now, is learning to be in love all the time. And when I'm not in love, I have something to look at in me. When I'm angry, when I'm judgmental, there's something about myself that I have not forgiven. I'm blaming you, I'm attacking you, I'm making you bad. But really inside I've made myself bad because I've done the same thing. Or I've done something so similar and I haven't forgiven myself for that time that I didn't forgive you. Or that time that I let you down. And so when you die and I'm madder than hell because you've died, that anger comes from the time when I let someone down and I didn't forgive myself for it. So the path to love is through forgiveness. That's why forgiveness is so big now. And Marianne Williamson says, you know, very nicely, that forgiveness is the pivotal act, mental act, that allows us to convert hate, anger, fear to love. And with that, I'm going to stop now, and I'd love to hear any comments you have, any things you want to share that add to this, and maybe we'll go out stronger, more loving people than when we came in. So I've used up more time than I anticipated, but I hope it was worth it. So if you have any comments or anything, I please, yes.
Well, I just wanted to respond to one thing he said, and for the in general, I am in, you know, I couldn't agree more with what you said. But there was one thing about the only way to heal the traumatic experiences is to go back and reconnect to them and heal them. And while I support that, I think there's probably quite a few people who can't even remember the traumatic incidences or the neglect that they received. And that I just wonder if there's also ways of healing that those experiences through some of the same practices that you mentioned, and that, you know, just applying love in general is going to help that that heal and recover.
I certainly think it will. Applying love is always going to open up. Well, you know, they say love invites everything unlike it to come forth. So you got to be prepared. When you start to love yourself, things you don't like are going to come up. To be healed, to be given love, to be really seen. To be given love means to be given attention, to be noticed, to be seen, to be recognized, to be acknowledged. And in that process, the healing takes place. And that's Pema Chodron talks about, you know, holding all your nasty thoughts, your demons, whatever, like a baby. And that's really kind of what she's saying, is love your... That's kind of the slow way of doing it. The meditation way is the slow way of doing it. If you want to go into hyperspeed, well, I went into hyperspeed when I did this work, because it's inquiry, it brings forth the consciousness. So when I do a Katie process, it would bring things, and I did a lot of them writing. Writing enabled me to connect with things that I couldn't consciously think of. And over time, you know, when she asked the question, is that true? Like, you know, I want my mother to love me. Is that true? What do I get out of that? What do I get if I don't have that, without that thought that I need my mother to love me? Well, I'm a happy person. You know, I'm a happy camper. What I get when I want my mother to love me or I need my mother to love me is I get mad, I get angry, I get frustrated, I get judgmental, I get feel bad, I feel deprived, I feel... This, that, through doing the inquiry process, it led me to understand my own unconscious feelings, led me to name them, acknowledge them. I had to go this kind of circuitous route because I couldn't remember. And that's what I'm responding to you is, there are ways to deal with the things you don't remember, because I didn't remember anything. That's why it took me so long. That's why I didn't heal in my 30s or 40s or 50s when everybody else around me was healing and going to therapists. I wasn't, because I couldn't remember any bad thing happening. So that's my response to that.
Okay. And I just remember there's a word that I sort of forgot to enter, that idea of neuroplasticity too, that, you know, that we can change our neural pathways almost any point in life if we, you know, choose, you know, if we make a conscious effort, become conscious of our thinking and where we're going with it and guide it along.
Exactly. It's becoming conscious of your thinking. That's what I mean by reconnecting, when you become conscious of your thinking.
Yeah.
If you don't become conscious of what you're thinking, it won't happen. You have to be conscious of that.
And
it does, your neural cells will grow again.
Yeah.
They will.
And I wanted to share that... my brother and his wife adopted a boy that was raised in an orphanage in Russia, and so, you know, when they adopted him as three, he had, you know, it was soon discovered he had learning disabilities, and while he has never learned how to read, there he's had a, you know, 20 years of a really loving family, and he's pretty well adapted even to having a reading disability. I mean, you know, I don't know what his whole life story will be,
mm-hmm.
but I can see how there was a lot of healing
mm-hmm.
that took place. A lot of attention has been given to him. And I also just wanted to lastly say that I'm also a student of Leslie Temple Thurston's, and it's really nice to hear her name mentioned, so thank you.
You're welcome.
Her work has been really profoundly helpful to me. And I use it in many different forms, as some of my friends here. Even in I live in a co-housing place, and we've used it on issues at the community, and mostly it's pretty helpful. So.
And you're going to be giving a workshop on that.
I am going to be giving a workshop on that. If anybody's interested in learning about this, using the square, see me. There's a clipboard around somewhere with a sign up. Thank you for mentioning that. Supporting.
Where's the clipboard?
It's here. I will pass it around. Good. That's a good... And there's a few flyers over there for some other things that I'm doing. These are mostly women's things. They're up by the cash register. But this is the clipboard. Like, if you're interested in classes or workshops, just sign your name so I can read it and make sure I can either read your phone number or your email address, something. So, and I'll be happy to let you know. And at work is very powerful, and I love it. It makes me, every time I do it, I feel a notch lighter, and it's inch by inch, step by step, you know. You had your hand in.
Yeah, I was thinking about what you said, because I had a very traumatic childhood, similar to yours, where I don't remember what happened for like the first 5 years, but I have feelings, senses of something. And what's really helped me is my dreams, because I can't concretely say that this happened, but my dreams I just totally trust, and I write them down every morning. And even if I can't remember them, I'll write something, and it kind of gets me there, and it stops me from trying to force something.
Mm-hmm. Janoff says, even your dreams, feel the feelings of your dreams.
Yeah.
Connect with your experience. Make mm-hmm. your experience conscious. Bring it to consciousness.
So have you done a lot of, you haven't mentioned dreams, but you've done a lot of different things.
A lot of different things. I've done some dreams, and when the dream stands out, I pay attention.
Yeah.
I totally pay attention. What is it, you know, what's this dream about? What is it telling me?
Yeah.
I love dreams.
I do.
I don't have the ones where you have orgasms.
No,
haven't
I
progressed.
Don't maybe.
There's a book about a woman who does, and she's a Sonoma woman, I think. Mm-hmm.
I didn't read anything really
there. That's okay. Sari, and then.
I was just going to say, for a while I started to write my dreams down, because I was having such vivid dreams every night, and then I started to tape them because I was remembering so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to therapy at the time, and I would sit and talk about them. They were so vivid, and it really did change a lot of my perspective on my life and my feelings. I mean, it really had a profound effect. And I also mm-hmm. noticed once I started the process of paying attention in the morning, I could remember so much, and the dreams became even more vivid. And it was really helpful information and really healing information. I mean, it told me so much about mm-hmm. what was really going on in my life and in my past. And it was really, I thought, really helpful.
Yeah.
It was profoundly helpful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll even have dreams of a place that keeps reoccurring, keeps coming back. And the more, like, I look at what it is and just focus on that very simple thing, it seems so simple, but it's really meaningful. So
yeah,
the more I do it, the more I get more from it.
So dreams are good. Dreams are good. Good way to know yourself. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I've played chess a lot in my life, mm. so I was quite interested in the two figurines on your table there.
Mm.
And one of the things that happened when my father was teaching when I was like 11 years old, he said, well, here's the main man. He can go anywhere he wants, but he can only move one space in any direction. I said, well, that's the way the man should be. And then he told me there's the main woman. She can do the same thing, but she can go wherever she wants. And as a young boy, 11, I was outraged. Such a thing. Impossible, you know, especially after learning that this was an ancient game and everything.
Uh-huh.
And after years of playing, I played in the New York Chess Club, and I played in San Francisco and other places. And what happens, if you are a an avid chess player, you start to see patterns that are on the chessboard transmitted to life.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
It's hard to explain, but you'll see the moves. And one of them is that the main aspect of the game is that if the main man is taken, the game ends. But if the main woman is taken, the main woman that remains on the other side, she gains power, an awesome power over the rest of the continuum of the game, because her the opposite queen is missing. So you think there's a sense of doom that exists when one player has a queen and the other doesn't, because it's a very powerful piece. Well, in life, there's this sense of tradition where women, it's not so much anti-women or women are less than men. There was some kind of, in ancient times, where there was a great respect for women for some reason, and men were attracted by that in the sense that was real. My question is there a actual objective behavior that women have towards men and towards their obligation towards life and you know, the idea of Mother Earth and things where it starts to pop up in life now, like our, we have Feinstein, Boxer, and Pelosi. We have Hillary that may be a president soon. We're noticing my boss, I'm a truck driver and I work at a big trucking company, and my boss is a woman. And her assistants are women too. And at my shop, or have the people I deal with, they're all women. And a lot of the political appointees in Sonoma County are women, when you check it out. And you can go on and on. And you can see in things like Hollywood couples, like Brad Pitt and what's her name, Jolie, how you can feel it, even in those magazines when you're waiting in the supermarket, you can feel there's something that she has over him, even though he's posing as a man.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that with Bill. I get the sense that Bill Clinton like moves one space at a time. Hillary moves a whole bunch at a time. You see that happening.
Yeah.
So objectively, is there like things that we've lost contact with, and that maybe we're not supposed to be equal? There's certain roles that a higher power wants us to emulate. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
Well, what it makes me think of is I am a mother, I have a daughter, and from that experience of parenting, I had to draw on things I never had to draw on before I was a parent, and they were just like, you know, they came out, they were brought out. So I feel like as a woman I have the capacity, and actually whether I have a child or not, I think I have this capacity as a woman to in a way take charge, to make sure everything's running correctly so that my child will be safe, to make sure that there's food, that there's shelter, that there's money, that there's security, that there's a network, that all these things have to be in place or my child is threatened. And the other thing that comes up to me is the tool that women have, I want to say, I'm not sure what word to use for that, is that women are attractive. That, you know, Angelina is attractive to Brad. And being strong is... I've had men tell me that they liked it when I was strong. That women can't conquer men, women through strength. That's never going to happen. And I don't think they're meant to. I think they are meant to attract through being attractive beings, loving beings, beautiful beings, compassionate, heart-nurturing beings. and that that is their strength, that is our strength. It comes back to love again, and that love is attractive to us. It's really hard to resist love. So that's what I would answer to that, and maybe somebody else might, you know, there may be other answers to that.
Well, you know, if you know, there's that famous cave etching, that the oldest art, you know, of this very large woman scratched into the rock,
mm-hmm.
and it was supposedly it was a spiritual symbol of that time. This is what it was interpreted to be.
Well, that those are associated with the power, like the one if I'm thinking of, the Lascaux, I think it is. She's holding something that's got 13, she's holding a stick or something that's got 13 lines on it that stand for the 13 moons of the year, the 13 cycles of menstruation in a year. That is the power of fertility, the power to create, which is magic, totally magic. It's like we can't create it, we can't reproduce it, we can't, you know, we're just in awe. It's magic, and to that we owe gratitude, to that capacity. The women have that capacity, and to men also. So that is something that's totally honored. In the ancient cultures, they revered that magical, wonderful, irreplaceable quality. So to me, that's what that is about, you know, and it's just as magic now, and women can still die in childbirth now, just as much as, in fact, they die a lot now in childbirth.
Well, it is magical, so like, I mean, like they divide in half, or this I mean, we don't really, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people do, but it's quite an amazing thing that you ladies have this equipment to keep the race going.
It is.
It gives you a certain kind of authority on the planet, you know, or
value, you or something.
Can connect with any race through the other women because of this one, this
capacity. Thing. And we don't just have the, it's not only, this is really important, it's not only the physical, our physical capacity to generate life. We have qualities that nurture and support life. We have qualities, we care about certain things. It's all the other qualities that make it possible to sustain the life that we bring, that we should be very proud of. That's what kept us alive. I think I don't know, do we have time for one more? Or?
Yeah, one last question.
Okay.
One more question.
You, this wonderful, love your what you're wearing there, beautiful outfit. Yes.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, once I was traveling in Greece on an island called Samos, which is very close to the Turkish border, and I kept seeing these ceramic souvenirs for the tourists to buy, and after I'd seen it about a lot, I finally asked the proprietor what it meant. It was actually about a 12 by 12 inch with 12 figurines, and there was a moon, crescent moon above it, about that big, the whole thing. 12 guys mooning the moon. And I said, what's the significance behind this? And he said, aha, madame, please have a seat. I want to use some tea and I'll tell you. So he proceeded to tell me, he said that back in the day when there was competition between the men and the women, or the priests and the sagacious, wise women, that the men thought if they had the ability to menstruate and to bear children, that they would get the wisdom of the women.
Mm.
And by bearing their butts up at the moon, they thought that then they would be able to get this ability to bear children and to menstruate.
Mm.
But the point is that it's actually venerated to have the wisdom of the women, and that they're admitting it, they're owning it,
mm-hmm.
they're admiring it and keeping that in awe.
Yay.
Very
yay.
And that and the Satyricon with these big phalluses walking around.
Oh.
This is what to bring you luck. in our ancient wisdom.
Well, thank you for sharing that, and thank you everybody for coming. I really thank you for listening to me and for sharing your thoughts. And if you have any questions, I'll ask them, answer them afterwards. But now I think I would like to turn the mic over to our fearless leader here.
Thank you so much. That was excellent.
Oh, you're welcome.